You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about one historical football team.
Jean Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Jean Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up, and all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin. And while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe, in 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville Four-Wheeler Drive Truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomp. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road, about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage at coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger is now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bunger's had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing the football net, but it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds like sometimes 3,000 people at that game because, you know, years ago there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game, people followed everything, and now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering, you know, it's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just, this is history that people should know.
You've gotta be a football hero to get along with a beautiful girl.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to university endowments and students pressuring their institutions to end financial relationships with the fossil fuel industry. A coalition of students from Yale, MIT, Princeton, Stanford, and Vanderbilt, they took legal action against their universities in February. Closer to home, Marquette University trustees approved an updated investment policy for the university endowment last month, prohibiting any of it from being directly invested in public companies conducting oil or natural gas exploration or extraction. So should higher ed move away from fossil fuel investments? What do you want the Wisconsin universities to do? 800-642-1234. Anne Turlock is an associate professor of management and human resources in the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. And welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, explain what you consider forms of divestment from the fossil fuel industry. What does that mean? What does that look like?
It essentially looks like selling shares, ownership shares that you hold in fossil fuel companies, could be exploration, processing, and then investing it elsewhere. Now, it's not always direct investments where you hold individual shares in individual firms directly. Often endowments are invested in mutual funds where it's a basket of firms that you're invested in, and one sliver of these of this basket could be firms related to the fossil fuel industry or operating in the fossil fuel industry. And it's essentially selling these shares, yes, and investing it elsewhere.
Is it sometimes hard, though, to really truly understand what pieces of the investment are clearly, in the fossil fuel industry, or is it pretty transparent?
Well, it depends to the extent that it's direct investment. So you hold individual shares in an individual company, that is pretty clear, obviously. Mm-hmm. If it's in a fund, it gets more complicated for sure. Also, it depends on how these funds are constructed. Firms may move in and out as they are, if the fund is actively managed. So then it's not always clear if at any certain point in time you hold shares in a fossil fuel company.
Why do you see? Go ahead.
And that's different to having a fund that's sort of indexed, that has a set of firms. There might be a certain percentage of fossil fuel firms in there. Yes.
It'd be a whole mix in that particular index basket.
Yes.
So why is divestment being raised on more and more college campuses? Why are we hearing more about it?
I think there is the perception that it could help, that divestment could help in our fight against climate change. And clearly we have to do something there to address climate change. I think there is this thought that back then when there was a divestment movement in the context of apartheid in South Africa, it somehow seemed to help end apartheid. And so there's an analogy drawn often there. Now, that's debatable, though, if really the divestment would lead to reductions in greenhouse gases, which is really what we need to focus on here, among other things. Because ultimately, as you divest, other market participants would just be purchasing those shares that are being divested. And the idea that you defund these fossil fuel companies through divestment is practically not very, it's not very real, it's not very plausible. Is it theoretically possible if about, 84% of all investable wealth gets divested from fossil fuels, that it would have an effect on their share prices and would defund them, quote unquote? Yes. Is it plausible that 84% of the shares that are out there would be divested? Probably not, of the investable wealth.
Companies like BP and ExxonMobil and Shell, they have tons of resources, immense profit and wealth. And that, I think that you're getting at, can divestment from these academic institutions and these nonprofits and others make any meaningful difference, or is this mostly symbolic?
Indeed, yes. So and on the financial market, it will not make a difference. And I think there is actually more or less consensus around that. And in fact, if you look back to the parallel to the divestment in the context of apartheid, financial markets did not respond. It did not have an effect via financial markets. So then the idea is, might it have an effect through some symbolic action, right? By calling out the destructive nature of fossil fuels, essentially shining a spotlight on the issue. I think you have to carefully think about that. So I think there is not everyone would necessarily agree that fossil fuels are inherently evil. Unlike in the context of apartheid, I think everyone agreed it was inherently evil. There was congressional action around sanctions to sanction the South African economy.
Here's the thing. We all depend on fossil fuels and have a very long time, universities included. So if fossil fuel use were to end tomorrow, we'd be in a dire situation. Is there something too hypocritical here about this?
Certainly, that argument has been made quite a bit, that if indeed we feel it's immoral to, or if there are folks that feel it's immoral to profit off of fossil fuels, then the logical consequence would be to boycott the use of fossil fuels, right? Mm-hmm. And people will say, well, that's easy, more easily said than done, because fossil fuels companies have put us in a situation where we have no choice but depend on fossil fuels. And that to some extent might be true. At the same time, I feel there is a lot of discretionary use of fossil fuels, so non-necessary use of fossil fuels, the trip that we make out of convenience in the car, right, as opposed to riding our bikes. And so that is certainly true. And then there's also the other question of, if really you feel it's immoral, if we're asking endowments to divest, we have to ask ourselves too, we're asking endowments to divest the money that the donors have entrusted the endowment with, right? The foundation or endowments are asked to act on someone else's call, what to do with the money that the donors gave them. Wouldn't it be more plausible for us to ask those that manage our money to then divest from fossil fuels if we feel that that's needed? And that would be something like our own pension funds, like SWIP, the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. There, I feel it is a little bit more directly linked, right? Because as faculty, for example, is our money.
Let's pause right here with UW-Madison Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources, Anne Turlock, our guide to university endowments and investment ethics. Do you think fossil fuel investments conflict with the mission of universities, or should their portfolios be free to have a mix of energy assets? What do you think of students suing their institutions over fossil fuel investments? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Anne Turlock here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Universities have been under pressure from their students to scrutinize their pension funds and endowments, untangle them from fossil fuels. And just last month, Marquette's trustees voted to phase out any fossil fuel-related endowment investments. But the university also made clear its current investment portfolio does not include any direct public investments in fossil fuels. How do you want your alma mater to approach this? 800-642-1234. UW-Madison Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources, Anne Turlock, is with us for about 9 more minutes. And let's look closer to the UW. There's a coalition of 11 groups on 6 UW system campuses pushing for fossil fuel divestment. What have you seen out of the UW to the response to this?
Well, there's two sides to the response. So there's the Faculty Senate, right, that has passed a resolution asking the same thing, that the foundation divest. On the foundation side, they have responded that they will not divest. They feel that the donors entrust them with their money, the donors' money, and they have an obligation to invest that money in the donors' interests, which is to essentially balance risk return and provide for stable returns that can then support the UW's operations and really the teaching and the scholarships and professorships that are often in fact used to research and teach in climate change and how to transition into a clean economy.
I think I was just going to say right there what you said, that is a pretty tricky problem that universities are also grappling with. You know, they have this money coming in, large donations from the energy industry, funding research labs, as you mentioned, funding positions and things like that. That there is also very sensitive and tricky with money from the energy industry.
Yeah, I don't know how much the energy industry functions as a donor to endow gifts with the foundation. I think there the financial connection would more be through grants that are given to research labs, I think. It is more that those that do give, so it's often alumni that give money, alumni, and it is not, I think if the foundation heard their donors say, we do not want you to invest in fossil fuels, they would listen to that because they feel that it is their responsibility to act in the donor's interest, right? And the donor's interest is to use that money to optimally support the UW-Madison. And by categorically excluding a whole set of investments, the foundation worries that they may not be able to do that. Now, foundation also does not have any direct investments in fossil fuel companies. So in a way, they could, just like many of the other campuses, say, oh, well, we actually already are divested. We will not invest, or we have followed the call. But I think there is a notion of it being a little bit misleading it would be misleading because they don't have direct investment because it's just not aligned with how they invest their investment strategy, as opposed to them not having any stakes directly in fossil fuel companies because the divestment movement told them not to. So it would be a misleading statement.
So what about the litigation? Students at 5 large universities, Yale, Princeton, MIT, Stanford, Vanderbilt, suing their schools for violating the Prudent Management of Institutional Funds Act. What do you see there?
I do not believe that any of these suits have moved forward. We would need to look a little bit more closely on how the endowments are managed in those schools. So for UW, the foundation is a separate entity from the university. It's entirely separate, such that there is no governance relationship there between the university and the foundation. That is not always the case for other universities, where it could be, and I'm not a legal expert there, where it could be that suits brought forward by students, faculty, whatever, that are directed at the foundation or the endowment have more merit, you know, because there's a direct relationship, but there is none. There is the governance body of the foundation for UW-Madison is entirely separate. from the governance body of the University of Wisconsin.
Talking with Ann Turlock, who's an associate professor of management, human resources at the Wisconsin School of Business, teaches courses on corporate social responsibility and sustainable business. As we look at this issue, 800-642-1234, this issue of divestment. So can shareholders, do you think, apply pressure to fossil fuel companies without divesting? Are there other paths here rather than just divesting?
Absolutely. And there is a lot of voice that says actually through active ownership, through what's called shareholder activism, we could have a much larger, much more impact. It would move beyond it being a symbolic action because we could, as shareholders, file resolutions or suggest directors to the board of directors that then have a voice in the company. And in fact, we have seen that more and more happening. There are teeny, what's called activist funds that have succeeded in coordinating with the larger shareholders of a certain, of Exxon, that's a big example there, and have placed three directors onto the board of Exxon. And so and now being able to then guide that firm's actions a lot more effectively. Because again, just by divesting, you just hand those shares to another investor and don't really affect the company per se.
And before we have to go here, do you see the push for divestment growing on campuses, or might this diminish? What do you see in your crystal ball?
I think for now it will continue, and that is worrisome to me because to me, if it was a symbolic action that comes without cost, I would say why not? But I do feel there is a cost because it does distract from what I feel could be much more effective action against climate change. And for example, if we were to focus all that energy on lobbying, perhaps for a price on carbon, you know, that to me would have much bigger impact, or focus on more shareholder activism, that too could have a bigger impact. And so I worry about the opportunity costs here.
Ann, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ann Turlock, Associate Professor of Management and Human Resources. We have a link to an evening of fossil fuel divestment conversation. You can find that link at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.